Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. Well, the Trump campaign has lost 28 election lawsuits, but they continue to spread dangerous lies about the election. The front page of today's New York Times says Trump targeting Michigan in a ploy to subvert vote. The front page of the Washington Post says Trump wages a full assault to overturn the election. According to Reuters, half of Republicans say Joe Biden won because of a rigged election. Today's guest, Mother Jones reporter Ari Berman says the Republican Party's ultimate goal is to make it even harder to vote, especially in communities of color. Senator Lindsey Graham recently told Fox, quote, "If we don't do something about voting by mail, we're going to lose the ability to elect a Republican in this country," end quote. Ari Berman is a senior reporter with Mother Jones, where he covers voting rights, and he's author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Hi, Ari. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rose. Thanks for having me back. I appreciate it.
Well, it's great to have you back, Ari. One of your recent tweets says that the president of the U.S. is actively interfering in an election he lost and flagrantly trying to overturn the will of the voters. His GOP allies either encourage this or they acquiesce. Just because this attempted coup will not succeed doesn't make it any less dangerous. Can you talk about just how dangerous this is?
It's really dangerous. I mean, we shouldn't even be having this discussion right now, Rose. As much as I love talking to you, this election should have been settled by now. It was very clear by the Saturday after the election, when all of the networks called the race for Joe Biden, that the election was over. And then the Trump administration filed all of these baseless legal challenges. And the line from Republicans was, let the process play out. Well, the process has played out. I think the latest data is they've won 2 cases and lost 34 cases. So they've lost every major legal case, basically. They haven't succeeded in changing votes anywhere. And that should have been the end of it. And instead, we are entering an even more dangerous phase where the Trump campaign is basically asking Republican state legislatures to flagrantly disregard and overturn the will of their voters. And the states that we're talking about are not close states. Michigan was decided by 154,000 votes. To overturn a margin like that would be unprecedented. Pennsylvania was decided by almost 80,000 votes. These are states that were much more decisive for Joe Biden than they were for Donald Trump. In 2016, Donald Trump only won the state of Michigan by 10,000 votes in 2016. And so the fact that we've moved from one outrageous legal strategy, which was to try to throw out ballots, to now an even more outrageous political strategy, which is to try to overturn the will of the voters, is really, really disturbing. And I don't believe this is going to succeed. I don't believe that the state legislatures have the legal authority to do this. And I believe there would be incredible political blowback if they tried this. But the fact that we're even talking about it just shows how much democratic norms are being disregarded and undermined in this country right now.
Right. And we talked yesterday about whether or not we should bring up this, I don't even know what to call it, this bizarre press conference yesterday with Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell, Mike Flynn's lawyer, who's now working for Trump. They're now saying the election was rigged by communist money. They're bringing up Hugo Chavez. I mean, what do you even do with this, Ari?
Well, I've leaned towards the position of trying to ignore it because I don't think it's particularly productive to engage with people that are just lying all over the place. Now, I think that the media has been somewhat torn about this. Obviously, some members of the media view this as good content and as theater, and they don't believe that there's any truth to it, but they believe it boosts ratings and it is good for their bottom line. There are other reporters that have covered it, but tried to aggressively fact check it. I think that has been the position of the Washington Post, the New York Times, the major networks. Then there have been people like me, and I've noticed a lot of people like me that are actually experts on elections. We have been very dubious about engaging with these kind of things because it's just so obviously untrue. And even attempting to fact check it seems to give more credence to the claims as opposed to just ignoring them. So it's put everyone in a really tough position because the Trump campaign is just flagrantly lying all over the place. Their lies get more and more outrageous. And it's very difficult to actually fact check any of it because there's a whole right-wing universe that doesn't care about facts. And it goes well beyond Fox News to the darkest depths of social media. And any amount of fact checking by CNN or by Mother Jones or by anyone else is not going to change their minds, as we've seen, because people, millions and millions of people now believe these crazy conspiracy theories. And that's what's so dangerous about Republicans not condemning what Trump is doing by giving him so much rope. He is essentially hanging the party rather than them trying to hang the president.
Right. And that's something that we've been talking about this week. And that's what's keeping me up at night. Half of Republicans say Biden won because of a, quote, rigged election. CNN has been going on the streets talking to these people who believe that Biden stole the election. He is showing them evidence from election officials about things that just are not true, and they still don't believe it. And I think this is something we're going to have to grapple with, Ari, is how do we deal with millions and millions of people who are now saying that Fox is too, quote, liberal and going to these other outlets?
It's going to have major ramifications on democracy in a lot of different ways. Number one, it is laying the groundwork for Republicans to make it harder to vote at the state and federal level, because if they believe the election was stolen and rigged, they're going to support policies that are going to make it more difficult to achieve fair elections in the future. It's also making it harder for Republicans that don't agree with Trump to actually speak up because they're getting an incredible amount of blowback. I mean, Tucker Carlson had a segment yesterday with one of Trump's lawyers where he very delicately pushed back on her insane claims about voting machines being rigged and all this stuff. And Tucker Carlson was being called a traitor today on Twitter. And so I think that really what one of the things that Democrats need to do very aggressively is go after the social media companies, particularly Facebook, because I think a lot of this stuff is spreading on social media even more than Fox. I think Fox has been by and large more responsible than Twitter and Facebook have. Twitter, I don't think it's nearly enough to say a post is disputed when it's clearly wrong. And Facebook isn't even trying to fact check the president. So to me, social media is the biggest concern here. And what's happening on Facebook is much worse than what's happening on Fox. And once the cat is out of the bag, it's very hard to put the pieces back together. And I worry here that even if we have a something of a transition to power, and even if Joe Biden becomes president on January 20th, I believe that the damage that has already been done to democracy is going to be incalculable.
We're definitely going to do shows in the coming weeks and probably years about social media. I want to also talk about the pieces that you wrote. I mean, the arguments you're making is that, as you just said, the ultimate goal here is to make it even harder to vote. And you write in one of your pieces that Republican officials in states like Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania have conducted investigations that have gone nowhere, but they have support and backup from top national Republicans, including Senate Judiciary Chair Lindsey Graham, who said he wants his committee to investigate mail voting. On Monday, November 9th on Fox, he said, quote, "If we don't do something about voting by mail, we're going to lose the ability to elect a Republican in this country." Talk more about that.
You're already hearing these statements from Republicans, whether it's Lindsey Graham or Scott Walker or other state level Republicans, saying that we either have to get rid of mail voting or make it a lot more difficult since so many Democrats used it in 2020, even though Republicans have long used mail voting in previous elections before Donald Trump led a crusade against it. Just today, the Georgia Secretary of State, who's become something of a folk hero to liberals because he has defended the integrity of that election, says he wants to tighten the state's voting laws. He wants a photo ID requirement for absentee voting, all of this stuff, even though, again, all we're talking about is invented conspiracies. There was no evidence of voter fraud in this election. There were no evidence of irregularities. We actually had a remarkably smooth election, given that it was a pandemic and given that there were so many efforts to try to make it harder to vote before the election. We actually had a remarkably smooth election and incredibly high voter turnout, despite all of the barriers. And so instead of thinking about how do we remove some of these barriers to make it easier for people to vote, or how do we make things like universal mail voting or expanded early voting permanent because they were only temporary in some states because of COVID. Instead, we're having the exact opposite direction, which is Republicans at both the national level and in particular in all these states are going to now introduce legislation and pass new laws, making it harder to vote based on a completely invented conspiracy.
Well, and to your point about Republicans introducing these laws, what's not getting much attention, and it really deserves more, is that Republicans held on to state legislatures across the country, which is going to give them so much power when it comes time to draw the districting maps.
Exactly. So, I mean, the Republican majorities in all of these states, like in Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, have already been reinforced by gerrymandering because they drew the lines in 2010. And in many of these states, they're going to draw the lines again in 2020. Now, some of these states, like in Michigan and in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, there's going to be Democratic governors. Michigan's going to have an independent redistricting commission. So it's going to be a little bit different. But certainly, Republicans are going to control the redistricting process in a lot of important states, whether it's Texas or Ohio or Florida or Georgia. And they are going to do the same kind of gerrymandering, or I would imagine even more extreme gerrymandering, knowing that they're going to be able to get away with it, knowing that there's now a 6-3 majority in the Supreme Court, which has already shown no appetite when it was 5-4. To try to crack down on egregious partisan gerrymandering. So yes, one of the things I'm really worried about is despite the election of Joe Biden, attacks on democracy are going to get worse, particularly in states that are controlled by Republicans. And it feels like everything we're seeing now is just a prelude to what's going to happen in early 2021. So, I mean, we're fighting now just to prevent a coup from happening. But even if that doesn't happen, and to be clear, I don't believe that will happen, we are still facing some very dark days for democracy in the years ahead. We've removed potentially Donald Trump from the equation, at least when it comes to him being president. But we have not removed all of those other obstacles to democracy, whether it's Mitch McConnell, a Senate majority leader, or whether it's Republicans in control of all of these key states, or whether it's Lindsey Graham being chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee at the same time that he's calling Republican officials to try to throw ballots out. So the Republican Party is only becoming more extreme after Trump's defeat. And that's not going to lead to good outcomes for democracy in the years going forward.
I mean, it's so difficult to hear this because across the country, once again, to give a shout out to all of these election officials who worked so hard under really difficult circumstances with COVID, across the country, things were very smooth. And a lot of people now realize how easy it is to vote thanks to mail-in voting here in California. It might become permanent, which it should be in across the country. But as you say, Ari, we're about to see even more laws to ensure that that doesn't happen.
That's probably what's going to happen. I mean, this is going to be a big battle, but certainly in states where Republicans are going to be in control, they are going to do whatever they can to try to tighten the voting process. And the fact that so many Republicans wrongly believe that the election was rigged and stolen is going to make it a lot easier for them. And even if they didn't want to do these kind of things, their constituents are now going to demand it because they believe all of these things that are completely untrue. They believe all of these mail ballots were found in the middle of the night in Wisconsin and in Michigan and Pennsylvania. They believe that voting machines flipped thousands or millions of votes. They believe that poll watchers were not allowed to watch the counting of ballots. All of these things are untrue. But the fact that they have made these claims repeatedly, people believe them. And not only that, but they are concentrated in cities that are heavily Democratic, heavily Black, places like Philadelphia, Milwaukee, Detroit, where Republicans are already suspicious of these communities because they don't look like them and they don't vote like them. And so they're going to take whatever opportunity they can to try to reduce turnout in Detroit, to try to reduce turnout in Philadelphia, to try to reduce turnout in Milwaukee. And this is a very, very dangerous game they're playing. And this is why I am so disturbed by all of this fraud talk, because even if Joe Biden becomes president on January 20th, and I fully expect that he will be, all of the rhetoric is going to lead to very dangerous outcomes. And the fact that every time you think this is over, it gets ratcheted up is very, very disturbing. Now, I hope that it's over soon. I mean, Georgia certified the results today. I expect, hopefully, Pennsylvania and Michigan will certify Monday. And then soon after that, other states are going to certify. So this could be over in a week, or it could not be based on how things are going. But either way, the damage to democracy from all of the false things that Republicans have said is going to last for much longer.
Today we're speaking with Ari Berman, senior reporter at Mother Jones, where he covers voting rights. Ari's author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. If you have any questions for Ari, we'd love to hear from you. Also, how concerned are you about what is taking place right now in this country? Do you know anyone who believed that this was a rigged election? We'd love to hear from you. And how do you think we should deal with what, you know, the rise of social media, people really kind of living in their own boxes when it comes to the media and not even believing now what election officials are saying? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Ari, can you elaborate a bit about how this affects voters of color? Because one of your other recent pieces, actually just out a couple days ago, Trump's strategy for contesting the election, throw out black people's votes. His legal maneuvers are targeting areas like Detroit, Milwaukee, and Philadelphia. You write, though the Trump campaign has produced no evidence of fraud, it's clearly signaling through its strategy that such fraud can only be committed in Democratic areas with large numbers of black voters.
Well, the fact that they're going after black communities has had an impact in a number of ways. First off, they've tried to disqualify votes in all of these areas. They have not succeeded in doing so, but a main point of their legal strategy was to try to get votes thrown out in Detroit and Philadelphia and Milwaukee and other places. They've now requested a recount in Wisconsin that's only in two counties, in Milwaukee County and in Dane County, where Madison is. These are counties that are home to three-fourths of the state's black voters. They're only alleging irregularities in these Democratic cities and these heavily black cities. They seem to believe that all the fraud was committed there and not anywhere else in the state. And if you look at their attempts to try to block certification, they tried to block the certification of the results in Wayne County, Michigan, where Detroit is. And now when the State Board of Election or the State Board of Canvassers in Michigan meets, that's going to make it harder for them to try to certify the results because there's Republican outcry about alleged irregularities that never actually happened in Detroit. And so the strategy is really useful for them in a number of ways. Number one, they're trying to throw out votes. They didn't succeed, but now they're trying to block the certification of the election based on their baseless claims that they're spreading. And then they're going to next year come in and they're going to try to propose this legislation that's going to try to target these voters' ability to vote, whether that's going to mean making it harder to get access to mail ballots, or whether that means trying to cut back on early voting, or whether that means trying to have more restrictive ID requirements. I mean, these are all things that are going to fall harder on communities of color. And so I'm just really disturbed by everything that's happening right now, because I think it's going to lead to very bad outcomes. And I think it's really disturbing that certain communities are being targeted more than others. And there's all this talk in the media about all the gains that Trump has made with voters of color, but they seem to be ignoring the fact that Trump is trying to throw out votes from voters of color right now. And I mean, even if Trump made marginal gains among black voters, he still lost 80% of black men and 90% of black women. So these are constituencies that still voted overwhelmingly against him compared to white voters, for example. So, I mean, whatever the gains that Trump made, he still lost the election because he didn't win enough of these votes. And Republicans are still, I think, viewing black voters and others of voters of color, by and large, as targets, as opposed to voters that they can legitimately win over. And I think as long as that's the mind state of the Republican Party, we're going to see more and more efforts to try to suppress these kind of votes.
Let's hear from a few callers. Let's go to Tiny in New Mexico. Hi, Tiny. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for the show. You've talked a lot about some of the issues that I was going to bring up about voters of color. I mean, this is a suppression of the voters of color. I mean, this is historical. It's never ending. Every 4 years or every year, the Republicans are trying one thing after another to disenfranchise voters of color. But I was wondering, though, this new sort of suppression, do you think it has anything to do with Georgia overturning and becoming Democratic for the first time, I don't know, in decades, and other states doing the same thing, that there's this fear that this precedent has begun, and now they're, like, really fueled up to do, like, really dig into the Democratic voting situation and suppression of voters of color. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Ari?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, you look at the fact that Georgia going blue was a huge wake-up call to Republicans. And Trump didn't, I mean, Biden didn't win that state only because of voters of color. Biden also improved in, for example, wealthy, heavily white suburbs. But also, Biden's victory in Georgia was powered by voters of color, who we believe were over a third of the electorate in that state. And Biden did much better with those voters than white voters. And that's a growing part of the country. The demographics are growing. And so, yes, Biden underperformed with voters of color in some places. He didn't do as well with Hispanic voters in South Texas as he should have. And he didn't do as well with Latino voters in Florida as he probably should have. But he still did very well with voters of color. And Trump did very badly with them, particularly Black voters and particularly Black women in states like Georgia. And so I think the fact that these groups are growing as a segment of the electorate and becoming more influential, and also the fact that they are organizing so effectively is really worrying Republicans. And I think they're trying to exploit Trump's baseless comments of fraud as an opportunity to then put in place measures to make it harder for these communities to vote.
Right. And Republicans obviously know that there's a major demographic shift happening. I mean, the fact that a lot of people were even talking about Texas turning blue says a lot. I mean, it was just over 10 million votes, I believe, Biden lost by 500,000. And we've had a number of organizers on the show from Texas who say that they're laying the groundwork just to get more people out to vote and to ensure that there's more interaction, not just around election time.
Exactly. And then that was one of the big problems for the Biden campaign, is they didn't invest enough resources to try to win Latino voters in Texas, particularly in South and West Texas along the border. And they took a lot of these votes for granted. And actually, Trump did pretty well in these communities. And you'd think that the Trump campaign would try to build on this. But instead, it seems like they're going back to this well-worn Republican strategy of trying to demonize voters of color and trying to throw their votes out. And I think that's going to complicate a lot of their outreach. And it's interesting that you hear that Republican senators are staying quiet about what Trump is saying because they believe that it will help them in Georgia, for example. But it could also go the other way. It could very well hurt them in Georgia, both because Republican voters might not turn out if they believe that the election was rigged, but also the fact that Donald Trump is failing to recognize Joe Biden as the president and Republicans are failing to recognize Joe Biden as the president-elect may actually be motivating Democrats to organize even harder because they feel like this major victory of theirs was not recognized. And so I think it could go in a lot of different ways. But the fact that one major party is essentially standing up for truth and the other major party refuses to denounce these obvious lies is just a very worrisome development, because when the truth itself becomes polarized and partisan, we're in a very dangerous position in this country.
Well, thank you for calling in, Tiny. And over the last week, we've done several shows with on-the-ground activists in the Latino, Black, and Native communities. You can find those shows at yourcallradio.org. Ari, I know you're on a tight deadline, but can you stay with us for about five more minutes?
Sure.
Okay, great. So to your point about truth, we have a caller, Ruth Ann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruth Ann. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. I was wondering, I wanted some advice. I found that arguing with people who are stuck in their ways and presenting facts usually doesn't work, because facts aren't going to dissuade them. And I'm wondering, what would a suggestion be for how to approach people who are really convinced that the election was fraudulent and stolen and all of that stuff? And I don't think facts will work, so I was wondering what approach you might suggest.
Thanks, Ruth Ann. Any ideas, Ari?
That's a good question, because I agree with Ruth Ann that all of the fact-checking we're doing doesn't seem to be having any sort of impact. I would just point out that if the election was rigged against Donald Trump, then how is it that Mitch McConnell was reelected? How is it that Republicans still have a majority in the U.S. Senate? How is it that Republicans won seats in the House of Representatives? How is it that Republicans control all of these states. It doesn't make any sense that Democrats would try to rig the election against Trump, but not get rid of all of these other Republicans that are standing in the way of their agenda. And it's interesting because when one of Trump's campaign lawyers yesterday basically said that we need to start investigating the elections of both Democrats and Republicans, suddenly you saw Republican senators like Joni Ernst from Iowa, who were reelected this year, say this is beyond the pale. So it's like when you accuse their own elections of being stolen, then they start to get more defensive and they start to acknowledge reality. And for example, refusing to certify the elections in states like Michigan means not just certifying the election of Joe Biden, but that means not certifying the election of the Republican controlled legislature there, not certifying the election of people up and down the ballot. It's not just Biden that's on the ballot. And so if you can't reach them with facts, I would try to maybe ask them, how is it possible that Democrats were able to rig the presidential race, but failed to rig all of these other races, because that really kind of defies common sense.
Yeah. And Democrats got really pounced in Florida. Politico had a good article, I think it was yesterday, that I read. I mean, they lost House seats that they did not expect to lose. And it sounds like Democrats in Florida are having the same kind of debate that Dems in D.C. are having between the sort of the moderate wing and the progressive wing of the party.
Yeah, I mean, that's the irony of this election, is that Democrats underperformed in a lot of places. They didn't do as well in the U.S. Senate as they would have liked. They didn't do as well in the U.S. House. They didn't do as well in the states. I mean, Joe Biden's victory was really the only bright spot for them. And now they're doing everything they can to hold on just to that. And so I would have thought, based on 220,000 Americans dying as of the election, the unemployment rate being what it is, Trump being so erratic in his behavior, that we would have seen more shifts, but we didn't see those shifts. And I think that you have to really ask yourself why. Why wasn't there more of a reckoning? Why wasn't there more of a repudiation? And the fact is, we are a very polarized country where Donald Trump is very popular too. And yes, Joe Biden got more votes. He got 51% of the vote, which is a huge number. He got probably will end up getting 7 million more votes in the popular vote. But the fact that Trump brought out so many people, the fact that 48% of the country is so fervent and its support for him, really helped the Republican Party in a lot of places, particularly in more conservative-leaning states where the president remains incredibly popular. The Democrats just weren't able to make inroads there. And if they're not able to make inroads there or to hold these House districts, that means that they're able to win the presidency, but it's much, much harder for them to have a large majority in the House or to take back the U.S. Senate or to win gerrymandered state legislatures.
I'm glad you brought up the numbers, Ari, because right now Trump has about over 73 million votes. So 156 million people voted, which is a huge number. There are 240 million people who are eligible to vote. So a lot of people still don't vote. And I hear on, especially on TV, sometimes on the radio, that half the country voted for Trump, which is not true. You have about a third of the country not voting, just over a third voting for Biden, and just under a third voting for Trump.
Exactly. And Trump has never had a majority of support anywhere in the country. He's never gotten more votes than the other candidate. He's never gotten a majority of votes, but he's able to hold on to a very fervent base. And that fervent base doesn't just translate to the president, but it translates into influencing senators, influencing state legislatures. And I believe a lot of the maneuvering that we're seeing because of the election is happening because Republicans are still afraid of Donald Trump, because they believe that he has huge political capital in the Republican Party. And it's just really, really sad that they are more afraid of Donald Trump than they are willing to stand up for democracy and to stand up for the truth.
Last question, Ari. Given that this really, obviously, it's so dangerous on many levels, but the end game is to make it harder to vote. I mean, there's no disputing that, because the record speaks for itself. I just searched for voter suppression and Republicans on Google News. Hardly any articles, except for yours, one in the New York Times. Most voter suppression pieces came out more than about 18 days ago. Why isn't voter suppression getting more attention right now?
because everyone is fixated on these claims of voter fraud. And once again, Donald Trump is dominating the narrative. And the whole narrative coming out of the election was that the election was stolen. And media outlets are having to devote a tremendous amount of resources to combating something that is just demonstrably untrue. And therefore, they're not really able to pursue all of these other stories that are incredibly important. And this has been the situation for 4 years under Donald Trump. We're always reacting to things that he's doing rather than talking about what's actually going on. And I feel that all of the coverage, even the coverage that tries to debunk Trump, is happening on Trump's terrain. And I feel like we need to move off a different terrain and talk about the real threats to voting in this country. And the real threats to voting are not a manufactured controversy over voter fraud. It's that Republicans are going to exploit a manufactured controversy over voter fraud to do even more voter suppression in the future. And I believe that story needs to be told much more aggressively.
Well, another reason to support independent media and work like Ari's. Ari Berman is senior reporter at Mother Jones covering voting rights and author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. As always, Ari, thank you so much for your work and thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much, Rose. Great to talk to you again.
You too. Thank you. Coming up after a break, we'll be joined by Mike Shum, a video journalist and one of the filmmakers behind a new Frontline documentary called American Voices, A Nation in Turmoil. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to talk about another Frontline documentary, a new one just out called American Voices, A Nation in Turmoil. In this documentary, a team of cinematographers traveled around the country to talk to individuals and families as they confronted the spread of COVID. They talked to a barber in Oregon, a pastor in Iowa, an activist in Minneapolis, the owners of a floral shop in a Northern California town that I've actually never heard of called Cool California, C-O-O-L. And joining us to talk about this film is Mike Shum, a video journalist and one of the filmmakers behind the new documentary, American Voices, A Nation in Turmoil. You can watch it now online. You can find it at yourcallradio.org. Hi, Mike. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Rose.
Well, great to have you. So talk about how you all came up with the idea to send out cinematographers around the country to talk to such a wide range of people.
Well, I think part of the sort of inception of that really had to do with my friend from college, my undergrad at Colorado College. Basically, he went on to become an emergency medicine doctor. And, you know, in March, when everything started to lock down, I, like everyone, felt, or at least most people, I at least felt like I had to make sure to stay safe and stay inside. And then I get a phone call from Blair encouraging me to go out and film. And I thought he was a little crazy at that point. But after talking with him a little bit more, we both recognized that as a country, we were definitely facing this sort of unknown, this collective unknown, and walking into it together is worth covering. He had been reading The Great Influenza by John Barry, and he felt that there were just big gaps in how people were contending with the virus, the flu back then. And here, there was an opportunity to sort of look at the country from people's perspectives to see how they're interacting with the lockdowns, social distancing. I mean, there's just a lot of questions. And I think we just had a base layer of curiosity that we were trying to go for. And when I started to talk to other colleagues around the country, many of whom I've worked with before, we all felt there was a sort of calling in some sense to sort of figure out what's happening out there. It sort of started from there, that sort of general idea for historical posterity.
All in all, you spoke with 12 people in 8 different states, and it took multiple virtual edit rooms from Berkeley to Boston, New York City to the UK to pull all this off. Mike, over the course of the pandemic, we've done shows, gosh, about maybe a handful or more of Frontline documentaries that have been made under COVID, which is really incredible. So talk a little bit about how you all, you know, came together, got the footage together, because I was surprised to see that you even have had footage of people responding to the election results. So you all finished this just recently.
Yeah, I don't think that Frontline has ever done anything so fast before, if I can recall. So my colleagues and I, we've been working on this project since March, and I'd been in touch with Frontline before. I had served as a director of photography for one of their films, Predator on the Reservation, and so I had a relationship with them for some time, and they had known that I was working on this, but didn't really know what we were doing necessarily until they actually saw a bit of material that we were collecting. And so basically, I think this was now about 2.5 weeks ago, I get a phone call from my colleagues at Frontline saying, hey, we should take what we can of your material, see who works well. First of all, they were asking if I was covering the election, and I was, through the eyes of our characters. And so we had already planned to follow the election through our characters. And yet they felt a need to collaborate, which, you know, I was very interested in, but also terrified, because the idea of releasing something so quickly on such a short time frame necessitated a large and very robust team and this monumental effort to pull a film together with all our characters that we've been gathering for the past several months, and then release, which is now November 17th, a Tuesday, this past Tuesday. So.
And how did you find the people that you featured? Because you clearly spent a lot of time with them. You're interviewing them in their workplaces, interviewing them at home in some cases.
Right. It was a combination of things. I mean, I think for the most part, my producing partner, Blair and I would have conversations about, well, you know, who is out there? At least one of our first questions was, who's out there during the lockdown? Who's not interested in the lockdown? Social distancing. I mean, very much our film is about COVID and our interactions with it, and how to interact with it over time. And so I just decided to start driving south of Minnesota. I had not really spent any time in Iowa, and I'd heard about Sioux City, Iowa, and felt just interested, honestly, just a pure curiosity to see what's going on down there. And that's when I met Pastor Kerry of Cornerstone World Outreach, where he was very much against the lockdown and found a way to host his church service in his parking lot. And a lot of churches actually started to do that, actually. So I found that to be really intriguing. And then the more I talked to other cinematographers, it was a combination of research towards people who are both interested in talking with us, inviting themselves into our inviting us into their lives, basically. And I really did rely on the cinematographers to sort of put their heart out there and say, well, what are you interested in, and who are you interested in following? Because I believe Derek Knowles, for example, had suggested that he knew the barber down the street and wanted to actually just see what he was up to. Emily Thomas in Oakland knew this nail salon, and then decided to just keep talking with them for a while, knowing that small businesses were suffering greatly during this time. So these were all themes that we're keeping an eye on during this pandemic. And then it just sort of grew from there, based really on the cinematographer's interest and sort of a combination of conversations that we all had about, well, who are we focusing on and why, and if they're willing to let us keep following them further.
I appreciated the fact that it wasn't just sound bites. I think that's what has bothered me this election season, is you have sound bites, right, of people saying things that are just so outlandish, but you want more. You wonder, where do they get their news? Where are they getting this information? What really stood out for you about Pastor Kerry? Because he did not wear a mask. He said, why is it fair that the local shop down the street is open with a full parking lot, and yet I can't continue with my church services? And then we saw that he did actually have a church service, and no one was distancing and no one was wearing masks.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where, for me at the time, I wasn't interested in making a judgment call so much as interested in how we were interacting with this, struggling basically with this pandemic. And so in the spirit of observation, I guess, I was interested in really his ardent perspective against masks and social distancing. I disagree on a lot of levels. At the same time, I didn't want to stand in his way. And, you know, I believe he was interested in opening his his world up to me to sort of show why he's doing these things the way he is, and at least asking for at least a conversation in some sense. And that's kind of what I was interested in when it comes to a lot of people who, you know, many of whom I don't quite agree with, but I'm willing to listen and willing to sort of see, you know, wade through what you had noted before, sound bites. I mean, I think that's why I'm so, this film has become a big part of the way I've been interacting with this pandemic, that so much of social media and Twitter and such, it really just pulls our projections of ourselves to such extremes. And you don't know who's behind those tweets. You don't know who's behind these quick, extreme perspectives. But then when you spend time with people and you take the time to really walk down this road with them together, i.e. this pandemic, I believe that you get a little better sense. And I think that's what I was doing with Pastor Carey and many of the other characters that we've been following.
Right. And I wonder, we're getting so many emails from our last segment about, you know, how we deal with people who just don't believe facts, or people who say, well, that election official said that, but I still don't believe it. And I wonder, as a filmmaker, what are your thoughts on this? Because Morning Edition and All Things Considered have been running stories this week with interviews with nurses in the Dakotas, especially, but in the Midwest, who say it's so hard because I'm taking care of patients who possibly could die. And on their deathbed, they're still telling me they don't believe that COVID is a thing. I mean, I've heard nurse after nurse share these stories. And I wonder, as a filmmaker, what are your thoughts on that?
That's a very difficult question, actually, in a way, mostly because it sort of depends on the goal of what I'm trying to approach here. And when I hear about those nurses and I've read about them recently, and just thinking about really how COVID is just spreading like wildfire, it's devastating, because I do feel like, you know, as journalists, we really do try to inform the public, and yet so much of fake news and this idea of pushing narratives has really plagued the way we perceive information flow. And I think, at least for me, in terms of this film in particular, the goal was to sort of show that there are multiple perspectives here, and show that those perspectives and what you do sort of has consequences on some level. You know, right now with that film, with American Voices, much of the film was dressed around the election itself. So whether people believed that they should wear masks or not, or pro-BLM or not pro-BLM, I mean, there's so many issues and perspectives at stake, and they still have a point of action, i.e. being able to vote and vote in a certain direction. And so in this situation, as you speak to like these nurses, it's devastating, but their perspective has had consequences to some extent, where they weren't wearing masks and then are on their deathbeds at this point. And so that's the part where it's hard for me to say, you know, find ways to convince people, so much as just show that this is what we're contending with at this time. I don't know how we'll look back on this period, but I'm hoping that, you know, in terms of the filmmaking approach that we're taking, is that we'll be able to have an artifact for generations to come, to be able to look back and say, well, this is how this was done in America back then. And hopefully there's some lessons to learn from both our successes and our failures.
We're speaking today with Mike Shum, a video journalist and one of the filmmakers behind the new Frontline documentary, American Voices, A Nation in Turmoil. And you can watch it now online. We have it on our website, yourcallradio.org. You can also find it on the PBS website. Charles writes, I saw the documentary. Great footage. My impression was that something was missing in the portrayal of the pro-Trump individuals. On the surface, they were somewhat sympathetic, but what was missing was, where did they find their false information and very poor understanding of American history come from? They didn't think that they were racist, but maybe they were, or he writes, clearly they were. That may not have been possible given the project, but I would like to have seen this issue probed further. It's going to basically what we're talking about right now, Mike.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that's a fair assessment to an extent, mostly for two reasons. One is, you know, 50 minutes to spend with our characters is not enough time, I would argue. I wish we could have our audiences really spend a great deal of time understanding where these motivations and perspectives come from, and you know, to what extent their histories or their approach to history has impacted their perspectives now, like some of the more conservative characters in our film. And also, I think in a way, it's not that I was trying to investigate anything specifically so much as I did want to see how closely wedded they were to their beliefs, and over time, if those beliefs were shifted or changed or challenged at any given point. And I think, you know, what we see, or at least what we saw this past year, is a number of events that serve to challenge all of us. And those challenges quickly pull us into our perspectives and sort of opinions that really can be more extreme, but also sort of come from a source of perspective that I think very well, you know, could be understood better with, you know, more time with them, but also more time through the course of this pandemic. I mean, that's why we're not finished filming. We're still following these characters, mostly because we want to see how, at least how their perspective could potentially shift or potentially, you know, widen in terms of their the extremes of their perspective. So, and that's kind of what we're wrestling with. I think that's where the observation aspect really comes into play, where I'm not trying to push them towards anything or convince them of anything. I'm just interested in who they are and mm-hmm. and what they stand for, even if the facts are wrong. So.
Right. And again, going beyond the soundbite is just so, so important. Thank you for the email, Charles. And in our Thank remaining you. Minutes, Mike, can we talk about Sure. some of the African Americans you interviewed about Black Lives Matter and the killing of George Floyd? It was so interesting, especially to watch. And I'm sorry, her name escaped me, but the woman who is living alone and was watching the church service on her computer.
Karana Lewis. Yeah.
Yes. It was so interesting to watch her, first of all, talk about how she's really kind of come to enjoy her own company and living on her own. We right. see her watching her church service and singing in front of her computer. And what was so interesting is also watching her leave the house. Yeah. You know, she knows that COVID is out there, but she really wanted to find out what was going on with Black Lives Matter and have conversations with young people who were out on the streets.
Yeah, and I'll be honest here. I think that's a lot of what many people were feeling at that time when George Floyd had died and was killed. And even for myself, I remember feeling a need to go out despite the pandemic, because at least in Minneapolis, we knew that so many people were coming together. And for Karan, I suspect, especially her being an African American woman, really feeling the need to stand up against this. You know, I'm Asian American, so I don't come from or see a perspective as closely to her in terms of how she feels in her response to George Floyd. But I found that to be very powerful for her to face some degree of fear and have the, you know, the compulsion to get up and get out against her safety, I guess, in this sense. And so that's part of the reason why our characters, the people we've been following, are just moving to us, because they really do push and challenge the way we're thinking about them as things are moving forward. And so for her, she's constantly struggling and wrestling with her own safety, but also with these issues of race.
Right. And then also, and just see her just be so excited about
yeah.
the young people and the passion. And then she talked about her past and what she hopes happens moving forward. And then eventually we see her walking through a line of police cars in the middle of the yeah. day, basically saying, "Can I please get to my car? I just want to go home."
Yeah. Yeah. I think what was powerful about that period, and I'm curious what you think as well too, but that part of the film is really that the sort of the pendulum swing within one's mind in such sort of the adrenaline of being at said protest, but also the adrenaline of being faced with cops. And you can see the police, the law enforcement, you could see how fearful she was, and you could feel that fear rippling across African-American communities everywhere in America, where you could see that it's not just that moment, but it's centuries old wounds at play there.
Right. And that was what another man, and again, I'm sorry, his name escapes me.
That's okay.
He was going to a protest, and just really curious, but also you could tell that there was a little anger there, given that what he's dealt with, saying that a lot of people just still don't understand.
Yeah, I believe you're talking about potentially Brian Moore, the barber.
The barber.
Yeah. Brian's, you know, I think it's interesting talking with him and Derek Knowles, who's the cinematographer who's been covering him in Portland, Oregon. You know, there's a sort of exhaustion in his voice that is always so powerful to me, where it's so much to contend with, not only as a race, but as a whole community and just Americans in this time, and to be faced with it in this way during the pandemic, I think was just very troubling. Mm. and just disturbing on many levels. And for him, I think there's a degree of pessimism that comes through where I don't want to speak for him directly, but you know, my conversations with him and seeing him grow over time, he doesn't have as much trust in the system. I think there's a lot of consistency in thought, where you have the pastor not very much against the lockdown, right? But then you have Royce White and Bryant and others saying, well, they're against the law enforcement in many ways for similar reasons, just different contexts. Mm-hmm. So there's this interesting sort of dynamic between authority and liberty that's at play. And that's sort of what we're analyzing in a sense through these events and these moments.
Well, it's such a timely film, and we need more like it to really understand each other, hear each other, listen to each other. So thank you, Mike, to you and your team for working
so much
on this during COVID and putting it together so fast. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Rose. Really appreciate it.
Mike Shum is a video journalist and one of the filmmakers behind the new Frontline documentary, American Voices, A Nation in Turmoil. You can watch it now online. Go to yourcallradio.org.